sexy scandalous.
You take them out to lunch fast enough. I'm not.
Well, the two presidential candidates today, they quoted them saying they support public health.
Go ahead.
They actually announced the words public health. Yeah. They must have said it in Trump talk to CNN.
Or they splice pieces of that? Things together,
yeah,
right?
I went to I told
about getting at least $150,000 for your wardrobe for today.
Yeah, oh, it didn't work.
She keeps saying I'm not going to keep it, and I'm like, who else is going to keep it?
And I was going to pick up and tailor to her body.
So what if she wears blue jeans and...
Well, it's very sweet, because you know, like, from, like, the movie stars with their shows, how they did all those clothes,
yeah.
And the character they have. So if they, if the character, they didn't like the clothes, the character wore, they're like,
I can give it to Larry Crane.
I have a place, there's a place called Off Our Backs.
Yes.
That in L.A. that...
He was at the booth this morning.
In the Ohio.
what you believe?
You told me.
I told you.
And now I'm going to sit here and read this book this morning. And then, you know.
And I felt badly. Like,
some people walk away from me and they were just chatting. And it's like, I'm like, hurry up, lady.
What are you going to do? I think it's exciting.
Yes,
exactly.
Ryan, that's Thank you.
Depends how quickly that leadership needs to react. example, Bob and I were talking before the meeting, there's an ongoing situation in South Los Angeles in which our major hospital there closed over a year ago, and both he and I have been struggling with what is the leadership that needs to occur there. And in my investigations of where could I play the best role, I'm still learning that. And for me, that's a very long time in looking at what is the leadership required. Whereas sometimes the leadership required needs to be more quickly. So when I see that a strategy is needed that's larger, that involves others, that may involve multiple layers of government and community members and patients and all segments of the healthcare area, that to me is usually a situation that requires leadership. It also means mapping out a strategy and being willing to commit. For leadership versus management, it means really committing your heart and soul and not being willing to give up and being willing to say, okay, it's Sunday morning, it's 6 a.m., and I got to go do this and this and this, and it's because otherwise this leadership piece isn't going to happen. And it just requires going that extra yard, and you need to want to do that and empower yourself to do it, and even when you're discouraged, to never give up. So that's how I know it.
Any follow-up questions to Liz? Or any stories that you have to share about situations that you've been involved in that call for leadership?
Just one follow-up comment to that. Sometimes the interesting thing is that leadership invokes this concept of risk, and that therefore the corollary that is doing nothing is safe. But I think for people who don't accept the reality, what happens to them is somehow they figure out that actually doing nothing is very risky. And so they weigh in the bigger picture, which is why the strategy issue is important. Sometimes doing nothing can be really risky. From the standpoint of the communities we're trying to serve, it invokes less risk having things stay the way they are. So that's something I've seen come, particularly in community leaders.
I'll project. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. No, I figured you can.
No.
Okay. I think this risk thing is really quite an interesting thing. It isn't talked about in the chapter that I'm involved in the book, but working at the CDC, really pushing the FDA hard, had the commissioner of the FDA call the CDC about every 6 months and try to get me fired. Fortunately, I had bosses who believed in prevention and managed to keep that from happening. So it's that sort of personal risk that comes to people that get out front. People out front do get shot at.
Any questions? Follow up? Okay, let me ask Robert Ross a question. Can you describe the aha moment when an individual situation becomes a broader social issue?
Yeah, that's an easy one for me. My aha moment was in 1984 when I was practicing in at a community health center in Camden, New Jersey. And what was interesting was at that point I was a newly minted pediatrician funny things can happen when you get your academic training. You think you're smarter and better than you really are, because they have you go through these battery of tests, board exams and state licensing exams, and once you get all those pieces of paper, you say, well, I must be bad, you know. And then so I had that sort of, you know, I was trained in sort of, you know, Ivy League setting, and it's very prestigious children's hospital. And so I came to South Camden to save the community. And I got there about the same time that crack cocaine hit inner city America. And my aha moment was that my training had utterly inadequately prepared me for what crack cocaine was doing to the health of that community. And, you know, name an issue, crack had blown it off the charts. STDs, infant mortality, premature births, domestic violence, child abuse, HIV, AIDS, I mean, just name it. It was just being blown out of the water, literally in front of my eyes. And so for me, that aha moment was about, A, the social determinants of health and the limitations of medical care in addressing the health needs of a community. And secondly, watching community leaders rally to try and protect the community from this, you know, utterly incredible scourge of the combination of crack cocaine and the elimination of many poverty programs during that time. And so it is when I began to first my first foray into community partnerships, working with the local school to get a school-based clinic, working with the Planned Parenthood organization, working with community leaders that were doing youth development, and I didn't have any context that those kinds of partnerships would be relevant to the practice of trying to improve the health of a community. So my aha moment was really a crisis, and ever since then I've continued to remain interested in the social determinants of health and the issue of health disparities.
Well, you've asked a sort of an interesting follow-up question, and that is, how does that aha moment change who you are and the way you practice your leadership? Does that one experience become life-changing to impact how you're going to practice
leadership? Yeah, I don't know if it's life-changing in the way that who was it that saw the burning bush? Was that Moses? I don't know if it was that kind of life-changing, but you get a lot of little burning bushes sometimes, and you learn. I think that for me, during that same period of time, you know, one crisis leads to another opportunity. So the crisis of the crack cocaine epidemic led to the opportunity of trying to bring a school-based clinic to Camden High School, which had the highest dropout rates, violence rates, pregnancy rates of any school, high school in the state of New Jersey at the time. And I'll make the story really brief, but what happened was we were trying to develop the service array for the school-based clinic at the high school. And at the same time, some of you may be aware, Minnesota had the best experience with school-based clinics at that time, with terrific data about their experience and what it could do around family planning and reproductive health and other kinds of issues. So knowing that we and a couple of others were trying to get school-based clinics going in Camden in New Jersey, a right-wing Republican legislator had introduced a bill into the New Jersey legislature to ban any school clinics from having family planning counseling in high schools. And so as this was happening, the director of the Greater Planned Parenthood called me to see if I would testify in the state legislature against the bill, which I was like, you know, I'm a pediatrician. I don't do that. I don't do that. I mean, it just wasn't in my mindset that I would actually, you know, cancel a half day of patients to drive to Trenton to do that. And so I did. And when I got there, it was my eyes just opened up immensely to, number one, the power of a coalition, because I was not there alone. I was one of, whatever, 30 or 40 testifiers. And it was my first experience in seeing what a bridge-building coalition sort of could do. And I also saw in that legislative hearing how the data were pretty worthless. You know, we had reams of studies that showed that you know, these clinics didn't increase abortions and do terrible things to kids. And to the other side, that was meaningless. And so that was sort of another kind of couple of aha moments around the power of partnerships and the power of coalitions, the power of advocacy, but at the same time, the limitations of what I was trained in public health and healthcare, which is data. Good data drives everything. And it turned out that wasn't true.
Any follow-ups around this? Yes. I want to follow up on the mention of risk. Risk implies, means, the possibility of failure.
experiences have been out of failure. You know, it's the successes that get recorded in the book. But I'd like to know how your leadership has been shared by your experiences with failure.
Oh, this would be an encyclopedic 800 volume.
So, I haven't said anything, so I'll take the where I failed question. I think that I'm glad Bob raised the issue of risk, because that's absolutely the quality that I think about, especially as I'm battling hard to do some of the coalition building and multidisciplinary work that I think needs to happen for us to get to a different place in communities. And I fail in some way almost every day, and I think the quality of leadership is, what did I learn from that failure? How do I come back from that failure and maintain a relationship? Because it is about building relationships and building them across disciplines, and you know, having enough humility to understand when I failed, but also having enough confidence to know that even though I failed, it doesn't mean the entire vision is completely out of whack. And so understanding that tension and being able to come back from a failure and change course when I need to, and I think part of the humility for me has been. And I just have to acknowledge that, you know, I have an empty seat here, because Barry Zuckerman is my friend and colleague and mentor, and has been critical in helping me to do the entrepreneurial things that I do in the legal setting. And that's a question that he asks all the time is, you know, tell me about where you failed. Tell me about how you screwed it up. And that's okay. And there has to be room to make mistakes in leadership, but there also has to be room to acknowledge them and move on. So that is, I think that risk piece, that's the risk that a lot of people see, is like, I don't want to have to admit that I was wrong. That's the risk. So I don't know.
For me, failure leads to another conversation, a different conversation, and often it allows another point of view, and the learning from that point of view can then allow a whole series of other doors to open up, and especially working in communities. I work in small communities on the west side of Los Angeles. So sometimes the failure is you start something that's a program and it just isn't working, and it's because you didn't talk to enough people first. You didn't find out what they really wanted. Maybe what they wanted was an after-school program. And we do healthcare, so it didn't match up as well, and we happen to have some money, but instead we need to listen to that the after-school program is healthcare, and it's more prevention than an exercise and things than the kids will ever get if they go home after school and don't have anything much to do. So it's small things. I think the failure that we're struggling with now in the community I'm in is we have tremendous problems with gang violence, and we manage to handle it in 3-year cycles, meaning you're trying to catch the, you know, 6, 7, and 8-year-olds before they turn 11 to 13 and another kid is shot. Now, we have 8 locations, and 1, 2, 3, 4, we have a body count of 4, 1 kid shot in front of each location, daylight, nighttime, whatever. So we're clearly struggling with that, and I view that as a failure both for our clinics and our community at large, that we can't figure that out. And what we're doing is having extensive conversations right now, because it's really such a difficult issue.
I'll add something that sort of gets maybe the failure and the risk maybe together and what you learned from it. I think for me, the aha moment for me was, do you know where you were at 5 o'clock on June the 24th, 1991? Probably nobody in this room, except Joe Molinaire, knows where he was. And I was at a birth defects meeting, and I got this telephone call from a guy who said, I have proof that folic acid prevents spina bifida. And before that time, I thought it wasn't any better than a fairly good hypothesis. And it completely changed my interpretation of the data. And epidemiologists know what to do with randomized controlled trial data. That's what God's you know, gift to mankind is randomized controlled trials and evidence-based medicine and all of that, so you know what the heck to do. And so you figured if you picked up the telephone and called the Food and Drug Administration, they would this afternoon fix this problem. And not only did they not fix it, they made it really difficult. And I didn't know about building coalitions or that you needed to do this or that and the other. And I think what you learn from the failures, they have the first hearing, and at the end of it, you think they say yes, but their staff make it no in 2 months. And so you failed at that hearing to get the process done. Well, now, what were the reasons they used to not move forward? And you sort of invent. The first one I remember was that the American Academy of Pediatrics and the birth defect, nobody has written any recommendations. I mean, heck, the science hadn't been published yet. How could you expect the professional organizations to write the policy pieces? So we spent a year getting those organizations to write the policy pieces. So that took care of that particular one. And then as you go along the way, you hear what the resistances are, and then you're trying to figure out what it is you need to do to sort of finally neuter that resistance. And it turned out that we did all the science things, and finally in the end it was a bald-faced political push led by the March of Dimes that actually got the FDA to do what it said it had at that point absolutely nothing to do with the science other than the fact that the science was there and the people at the March of Dimes knew that. So and it depended upon who the people were there. I mean, you never know who that's going to be, and you're always looking for who is somebody that actually listens or thinks that what you say makes sense, or fact is sort of a reality check on yourself. When you have people say no to you for 20 weeks in a row, it's nice to run into somebody who says, ah, I get it, and you're right. It's really wonderful to think you aren't absolutely stir crazy.
Yeah, a quick failure. That one issue that as a public health officer, I was a public health director in Philadelphia and then out here in San Diego County. And in Philadelphia, I was able to push to get the mayor, then Mayor Ed Rendell, to come out in favor of a clean needle exchange program to prevent HIV. And a few years later, I got recruited to San Diego County. And so among the other priorities I had on my list of things to get done here, I wanted to get clean needle exchange done here in San Diego County. And so I said, well, it worked for me in Philly. It'll work for me here. Wrong. The county, my chief administrative officer, who was my boss, who I reported to, saved me from going public with it. But I had a number of quiet meetings with Clean Needle Exchange advocates here, and I said, well, you know, I got this done in Philly, and I'm going to get this done here. And I went to provide a round of briefings for the mostly white, mostly Republican county board of supervisors here, and I got cut to pieces. It was a real failure for me that I couldn't even get the time of day on this issue. And it didn't matter what the data said. And so the lesson there is what's come up before. You've heard about the power of coalitions. You know, Sun Tzu in the Art of War says, when you're confronting the enemy, don't go alone. And not going alone takes more time. It takes time to build a coalition. And you got to sometimes make time your friend and not your enemy. With fluoridation, which is another public health victory here in San Diego recently, one of the last large American cities to get fluoridation. And that took, I don't know, 15 years. So sometimes these things do take time. And you got to be okay with that. And you got to pick your battles. If you're going to go down in flames, make sure it's a really good reason why you're going to go down in flames. Because if you go down in flames getting out there alone, well, then what? So you better pick your battles.
Alan, I
wanted
to get back
to you on the aha moment.
You gave the failure side.
Okay.
What was your aha moment as an individual situation became a social one?
So I've had a couple of them, and I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge my mom, who's in the audience, who has supported my many aha moments over the years, some of them better paid than others. So what I would say, you know, I came to Medical Legal Partnership, which is really deploying legal aid in the clinical setting. I came there from the child protection department in Massachusetts. And what my aha moment was that the intensive litigation resources that are deployed for kids who are at risk matched against the almost non-existent resources that exist to support families who have legal needs that are low income. My aha moment was that the legal aid community in the United States does not have a capacity to practice prevention, and that prevention was an ethic that was really important to support families and to make sure that they didn't end up in places like the child protection system, and that we needed to reorient how we thought about legal aid and legal aid service delivery and get away from an emergency room system and move towards a primary care system analogous to what has happened in the medical community. So that was my aha moment that I could embrace prevention as a legal aid attorney and bring to the vulnerable populations that I saw the same level of access to legal assistance that middle and upper income populations rely on, not just enjoy, they rely on it. And that was a missing link for families in terms of their ability to protect themselves from the negative impact of social determinants, right? That legal intervention is a way to protect families. So.
Follow-up challenge? Any follow-up question? Okay. You know, one of the interesting issues and dimensions of the whole crisis leadership movement in recent years has been that when people look at the way we've dealt with emergency preparedness and response and some of our other public health issues, they've often looked at it relative to the tipping point, the thing that Malcolm Gladwell talks about in his very well-known book. And so since you're an epidemiologist and since the tipping point model, Godfrey, is built on an epidemiologic model, what was the tipping point when you thought the evidence was solid that folic acid prevented spina bifida? And what sort of difficulties did you run into trying to get the fortification done?
Well, I said a little bit about that earlier, but I mean, epidemiologists live, at least some epidemiologists live, and think that the greatest thing in the world is to be involved in something that lets you know whether something works or doesn't work. And we have so much in the newspapers that in the long run never seemed to work or was a scare that wasn't necessary. But to get something that's for real and really this aha moment and an epidemiologic tipping point for me was I really didn't think that nutrition would have much to do with preventing birth defects. I thought it was sort of a nonsense idea, and I had written about it and said I thought it was a silly study that had started out because it wasn't the right kind of study. Then the right kind of study came, then it changed everything about it because the study was solid enough that I could bet the farm that folic acid would prevent spina bifida and anencephaly. And I knew from work that the team at CDC, and Joe Molinaro is one of the members of that team, is sitting in the audience here today, and I had an incredible group of wonderful professionals there who made sure that the science was right on everything I needed to talk about. I never had any insecurities that when I got to talk about something that Joe Molinaro and Dave Erickson and R.J. Berry told me was right was actually going to be right. So I had that security. And so when this changed, all of us had been working on this for 10 years trying to decide if this vitamin prevented or didn't prevent. And when we found out that we knew, then it was just in an instant we knew that if we got every woman in the world 400 micrograms of folic acid a day, we'd make this disease go away. And I think my biggest frustration in all of this is that the world hasn't been ready to accept that in the next minute. And so sort of the most ridiculous situation is the situation in Holland, where in Holland they have had two major panel reviews. The scientists look at it twice in the last 10 years, decided not to put folic acid in the flour, to decide to let children still get folic acid preventable spina bifida. And the only indication for which they practice euthanasia for our kids under a year are kids with spina bifida. And that is the most ridiculous example I can think of. So, you know, you can't believe that a Western democracy would rather let a kid have a birth defect and then kill him in the first year of life. I mean, no matter how you feel about euthanasia, that is not good public policy. And so, you know, how you deal with those things, one is to try to make it visible to people so people understand that that sort of silly stuff goes on. But the beauty of this intervention is that what you need to do is to turn a flour mill, the ordinary flour mill all over the world, into birth defects prevention factories. And the way you do that is that every flour mill has a box at the end of the line in which they bleach the flour. They put chlorine in there at some sort of rate, and it's a box. And they put something in it called a premix, and they have right beside it another box that's called the vitamin premix, and you put it in there. And the way you change this factory from into a birth defects prevention factory, instead of putting premix A in the second box, you put premix B in it. Your grandmother can do it with her eyes closed. And you have people like the industry in England who didn't want to do this in the first place said it wasn't technically possible to do this. I mean, it's just utter nonsense. It's like people throwing away all the data and saying they're doing this for some sort of political, selfish, some other reason. You have to try to figure out what that is. And what usually turns the day is you find people who know what spina bifida is. People who have spina bifida. I mean, spina bifida is having a child with spina bifida. Anybody here have a child with spina bifida who wants to speak up? I mean, having a child with spina bifida is a life-changing deal. It changes your life 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 a year. There's no question about it. It just changes it. And when I was in Ukraine, and we knew to have the wife of a lawyer who had a kid with spina bifida who was articulate in the room. And when the head of maternal and child health stood up and said, there aren't enough babies born in Ukraine for us to think about doing this, it didn't take 30 seconds for this woman to get on the floor and to tell the story. And that person, you know, heard it. So how do you make that coalition broad enough to turn the politics on it?
How do you as a leader, is it possible from a leadership perspective to predict potential tipping points? Or to figure out when people are suddenly going to get interested in an issue. And that's the, especially in the emergency preparedness arena, it's always been a concern. Can I predict the next event? Can I know when an event is going to change the people's views of the world? So
I think most of us aren't very good at predicting the future. The past we do pretty well.
I don't know. Maybe this isn't right on point, but for me, I think there are signposts to that tipping point, and if you're careful, you can see what those signposts are, and then you can adjust your strategy. And so, an example of that is that the American Bar Association last year adopted a resolution in support of medical legal partnership, and so for lawyers, that was just an amazing thing. It really changed it. Now, do my pediatrician friends really care? Not so much. They don't really understand what that means for our profession, that the ABA adopted this resolution. But I could see that it was gonna have a broad impact on the legal profession and how they respond to this model, and that I needed to make sure that the healthcare side met the commitment. And so for me, that was a sign that the legal community was starting to think about prevention.
But you're also preventing a tipping point from occurring because of the way Godfrey and you talked about understanding that there's an issue, but to be able to prevent that tipping point from occurring.
Right. We want to stop the emergency evictions.
Well, let me give you one signpost that I think the public, many of you have probably already experienced, which is in the policy world, things function very much on the issue of so the value of political currency, right? And political currency has a number of denominations to it, but among them are key are advocates and spokespersons for that issue. Okay? And a tipping point occurs when a highly regarded, highly respected, unlikely suspect, mm-hmm. not likely suspect, unlikely suspect speaks out on behalf of the issue that you care about. Okay? And so here, I'll give you an example. Here in San Diego County, it's very interesting. Coming from Philadelphia to San Diego, there are a few things that are really different other than the weather. One is Philadelphia is a very kind of your traditional, large, urban, East Coast, democratic machine politics. Okay? The politics there are not ideological. They're like gangs. They actually believe in the same ideology, but they just don't get along, right? It's just a different... Here, it's very ideological. Okay? The politics are very ideological. Okay? So you can't drive an expansion of mental health services agenda in Philadelphia with the same tools and tactics that you do so here in San Diego. In San Diego County, the best way to drive a mental health services expansion or drug treatment expansion is not with the usual suspects in public health or even in the healthcare industry. It's with the county sheriff, the DA, and the police chief. And when the county sheriff and the DA and the police chief, and if you're really lucky, the Chamber of Commerce, come out in support of expanding mental health, you will get it done. Okay? In Philadelphia, it doesn't kind of work that way. Okay? In New York, maybe less so. So it's getting that unlikely suspect, getting the... So by the time I got here and failed a number of times, I'd figured out, man, if I could get the sheriff... to kick off this policy thing I want to do and just kind of get out of the way and let him kind of take the credit and get the glory, maybe I can get a little bit further than with this thing than the way I've tried. And so the unlikely suspect, in this case the American Bar Association, advocating for pediatric prevention, is really part of the tipping point. You know you're in good shape when. And so those kinds of voices and identifying those voices that local editorial boards listen to and local elected officials listen to, either because those institutions make campaign contributions or because they hold some civic some civic currency, are very critical. My answer to that is easy after about the eighth failure. Time for a new model.
I was really blessed because I started my work in East Harlem in New York City, and my mentor was someone who'd learned community organizing in South America before going for her master's in social work. So she taught me early that if you could slowly build coalitions of sometimes the most unlikeliest people and make sure you worked with them around letting their voice be heard, in some ways, that's how democracy truly works. And I think one of the things I've learned over the years, and my battle over the last 15 years has been to continually fight to have health care services for people in LA County. We have over 2 million people with low incomes and no health insurance, and a county department of health that both lacks leadership and thinks that closing down seems to be the way to handle things. But what I've learned is that by finding the most unlikely people, which is what Bob had mentioned, and seeing and knowing right away. So when with the Republicans in power, when we were going to lose Harbor UCLA Hospital, I knew it was time to start literally going to Washington every month and working our congressional delegation and all the Senate offices in a large way. But we were lucky in that someone gave us a contact at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And I thought, no one, not the delegation, not the county officials, has been able to wake up anybody here at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid to save our hospital. But this gentleman, the minute he had had a lot to do with health care reform as a Republican in Massachusetts, and we started the conversation, and he said, so tell me why this is such a big problem. And when he realized what I was talking about was 500,000 people losing their health care, and that literally the whole health plan that he'd created for the state of Massachusetts covered less than a fifth of that, he started sitting in his chair like this with me. And by the end of the conversation, his nose was almost at the table. He'd sunk so low in his chair because he realized how horrific it would be. And then he looked at me and he said, who's your coalition? So I began naming some of the folks, and he said, well, I'm going to pull together a meeting with the secretary, and here's who I need you to bring together as a coalition. So whether you have one or not, you better get going and get some more folks together. And it was fabulous, because a month later, we were back with our coalition and the secretary. And a month later, the head of CMS was back at that hospital saying he was going to keep it open. So to me, it's been this learning curve of democracy works. It's slow. It can be ugly. The nice thing about it is when you do fail, you can just pick yourself up and dust yourself off and figure out a new avenue, because the other piece is most people in our democracy who really are passionate about something, they never give it up. And I think healthcare reform is one of those issues of how to have a healthcare system that actually serves everybody. It's a long, hard pull, and you know, hopefully we've got another 5 or 10 years and we'll be there.
I just want to, in response to that question, because I think our model is really predicated on the notion that messenger really matters, and that legal aid advocates can talk about housing access, and they can talk about food stamps, and they can talk about family stability until they're blue in the face. But when the pediatrician shows up, knows what they're talking about, and is on message, they're going to make a lot more progress than we will make in the years that we've been trying to promote an issue. And so my job is to make sure that the people who are going to make a difference in delivering the message that I need delivered are prepped enough and understand the issue enough and responsive enough that they can do that job. And you know, I've seen it happen over and over again when I am talking about an issue that I know intimately well because I'm a lawyer and I understand regulations, but if I can get a doctor who can speak equally savvy about that issue, it's going to move the dial much more quickly. And so I have to cede that territory to them, acknowledge them, and put them out front, because they're the ones who are going to make the difference in promoting the agenda that I really care about. So,
Bob, this triggered something that you said earlier. You talked about powerful stakeholders. And what do you do when your stakeholder, you think changes need to be made, and your powerful stakeholders want to maintain the status quo?
Again, this goes back to earlier comments about picking your battles and being patient. The thing about work in the public sector, because democracy is inherently messy anyway. I mean, even when it works, it's messy, right? Is that when you have a powerful stakeholder who's standing in the way, you really only have two choices. I know you think there's a lot of choices. There's really only two, okay, if you want to get something done. Either take them out or figure out a way for him or her to look good on what you're trying to get done, okay? I'm simplifying this sort of, but not too much. And there are very few people that, when I say take out, I don't mean in a violent act. But you know, you can't fire your mayor, right? If you work for the mayor, I mean, you can't fire your
boss,
right? You can't fire your. You can't even, you know, in government, it's even hard to fire people that work for you, right? So if you can't take them out, you've got to figure out, okay, what is this person about? And sometimes it means you know, Googling that person and seeing what their interests are. Maybe they have a kid with spina bifida, and you can, you know, bring them in on that. Maybe they're on the board of a group that advocates for domestic violence, and you can maybe kind of lever that. Maybe you can send someone else to help lobby that person who's not you, and you say, listen, I need you to take so-and-so to lunch, and here's my problem. So they're beginning to hear about this issue from others, you know, other than you, who maybe they trust. But particularly elected officials. Elected officials, the three rules are: get elected, stay elected, seek higher office. So you got to. Is there a way that your issue helps them on one of those three agendas? And then for non-elected stakeholders, I mean, there are other kinds of, you know, political levers. But if you can find a way for that person and his or her organization to benefit, and I don't mean just in a Machiavellian kind of way. I mean sometimes in a way that actually strengthens their agenda. Then you work, you know, you work that angle. And I hope this doesn't sound
manipulative.
Yes. But it's just that if you want to move something in you know, I mean, what did Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. I mean, it's really messy to get things done, and you're going to have to rely upon the personal and or organizational interests of that stakeholder and bring them around, and occasionally data will help, but not typically. In our case, last comment. In our case, see, if you want to stop something, you don't have to have the data. Okay? If you want to stop something from happening, you know, you can rely on people's fears, xenophobia, you know, scapegoating, anything will work to stop something. In order to move something, you have to have, we have to have both. We have to have the data and the evidence and a very powerful story to tell. Okay, you know, Elizabeth Shore says, "No numbers without stories, no stories without numbers." You gotta have both. And you know, you heard Godfrey talk about that. He had the data, but he had the person with the spina bifida story sitting there in the room. Okay, and if you have both in combination and you fail, well, then you know you've given it your best shot. Stopping the road to social justice is always uphill. It's never downhill. It's supposed to be hard, and it's supposed to be really messy.
Alan, since you're a lawyer and we can't take out our stakeholders or do it perhaps the way Bob was suggesting, how would you answer that question?
Well, I totally endorse every single strategy that Bob talked about. So I just want to second that. And I think it's, you know, what's that game, like six degrees of Kevin Bacon? Sometimes I think it's like, how many meetings do I have to have or does somebody else have to have for me to get to that person? I was, you know, engaged in a long campaign over the past year and a half with a couple of stakeholders who just, you know, I could not make headway with in Massachusetts, and it was really frustrating and frankly exhausting. So I think I just want to acknowledge that I think this is really exhausting work because it's work that involves relationships with people, and those can be really exhausting if you're not getting what you want. But you know, a lot of lunches later, that other people who were really invested in what we do. You know, I start to hear from meetings about this person that was a problem piping up about what a good idea this was. And that isn't because I convinced him. It's because the people that he cares about were convinced him. And the things, you know, all the things that Bob was saying. And so I think that, you know, I did some technical assistance with a site of ours in a Midwestern state where they're really struggling with buy-in from their legal aid executive director. And they're saying, we were just going to go out on our own. We're going to get our own 501c3. And I was like, that is really not going to solve the problem because you're just going to be competing. Like, let's figure out how to get this guy bought into your vision. Like, let's do all the things that Bob was talking about. What board is he on? You know, who does he esteem in the community that can whisper in his ear about how important it is? And again, messenger matters. So the thing that I hear from my friend and colleague who's a lawyer often feels very different from the thing that I hear from my friend and colleague who's a doctor, and I'll accept their version of reality in a different way. So.
You triggered something I remember. I once talked to a state legislator and said, you know, if we now have a school of public health in our state, we'll be happy to supply you with any information you might need on an issue. And he said, well, I don't need any information. I've already made up my mind. What do you do in that sort of a situation where you've got people that are so locked into a particular strategy and they want to maintain the status quo and they want to go against what you know is a better direction to go?
I really don't know how to answer that question, but I have a story that I think might fit in here. Is once I was terribly frustrated about something at the CDC. I don't even remember what it was, but I picked up a colleague at the airport, and he had a friend with him who ran a local health department. And I said to this guy, he says, how are you? I said, I'm just fine, but you know, this just isn't working. I don't know what the heck's going on. And he said, well, Godfrey, you just don't understand how the world is organized. And he just read a book written by some folks at MIT about the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the thesis of this book is that when Kennedy went to take out the Cubans, the first thing he had to do was to deal with 2 plus 2, how much was it going to cost, and what does physics do about the bullets and all that. And then the next thing he had to do was he couldn't do that without organizations, the Army, the Navy, the Defense Department, and all that. And they had certain priorities. And then above that, he had the political layer to deal with. And he says, what you guys in epidemiology don't understand is that the politics trumps the organization, which trumps the science. And once that was explained to me, it didn't solve a lot of problems, but it helped me understand the battles I was going to be in for.
And I guess I'll add to that, because I agree with Godfrey in that politics does trump a lot of it. But there's one thing you can do in politics. You said a state legislative person. My response would be, go down their fundraising list, see who their big donors are, call those donors up, see who you're friendly with or who you know that knows those donors. Those donors call that legislative person saying, this is a really great idea, I'd like you to back it. All of a sudden,
the attitudes change.
I had something very odd happen in the middle of, I think, our second or third county health crisis when I was at a meeting with one of the county supervisors with our coalition, and I was walking down the hall with a master, and I said, so I don't get why you can't, the feds are willing to come in and give you money. Why are you in the state arguing? I can't get why this isn't happening. And he said, well, I called the governor, and he won't call me back, and I'm not calling him again. Okay. So
let me push a little bit, because you're talking a little bit about the relationship of having information, having data. So if you have evidence-based research and population data, how can you use this to formulate policy in such a way that the elected officials and the politicians will build their decision-making activities on what we know are the facts?
It's twofold. You need the data in a one-page format that they can understand. Unfortunately, it's the data and how you message it. So it goes back to advertising is everything sometimes, and I think you'll see that in the tipping point when they talk about how you make a message more viral. You'll see that on the internet nowadays. So if you can get a message in a simple format to that official or to the people you're trying to influence, that's critical. And then on top of that, you need the politics and the influence. So if you have to see what's going to cause to shift that. And so with politicians, you have to recognize, just like I run a not-for-profit and I rely on private contributions, they also run a not-for-profit and they rely on private contributions to stay elected, and you can influence those people who give those contributions.
So. Yeah, I want to make sure we're not glossing over an issue that's equally critically important, which hasn't come up a lot. But before the world heard about Barack Obama, community organizing was kind of this closet function, right? But there are people who earn a living, typically not a very good living, understanding how to engage in an authentic way. Real live people who can speak with a very strong and powerfully thoughtful voice. Okay, and in children's health insurance coverage, we've been kind of banging our heads against the wall here in California. Our foundation have been funding a lot of these projects. And it just went to a whole nother level when we successfully engaged and went into a partnership with an organization called PICO, Pacific Institute for Community Organizing, which was a faith-based statewide, now nationwide, community organizing entity. And I would have, 7 years ago when I got to the foundation, I would have had no clue that we would have funded an organization like this. But let me tell you, they work at the local level, and they get people engaged, real live people engaged, and those people do put pressure on their elected officials. Mm-hmm. And they brought, 80, 90 busloads of people to Sacramento and had the governor's cabinet secretary and the speaker of the assembly and the Senate pro tem, and they were getting in their face about children's health coverage. And when you have 5,000 people on the Capitol steps making noise about children's health coverage, that beats a good, well-done paper, even in the New England Journal. So, it's kind of, we at the endowment, we call it grassroots and treetops. Mm-hmm. How do you get at the treetops, which is sort of the decision makers, but how do you have authentic, meaningful grassroots folks? And that's a whole nother session about how to engage those folks. You don't just tell them, hey, children's coverage is a good thing, and I want you to deliver 5,000 people to Sacramento. I mean, there's a whole lot of steps in between there around partnership, and you got to support their agenda as well. But it's been a very good and powerful partnership for us in terms of having real-life people who can mobilize en masse to deliver emails, make visits, show up on the Capitol steps, and put pressure on elected officials.
I hear you're also talking about the critical nature for leaders telling stories sometimes rather than just citing numbers in terms of the way they present their arguments. How critical are stories for leaders in terms of what each of you does?
Damn critical.
I say from the legal perspective, it's all about the stories because we don't do data on the legal side. We don't get it. We don't know how to measure it. We just think it. What we do works, and that's a problem, and we're working on that. But it is all about the stories and how do you tell the stories, right? Because everyone has their own bent about how they're telling the story. And for me, I think realizing that the lawyer writes a different story than the doctor writes, and that we do a much better story when we write them together with the patient as well. And so how you construct the story and what the magic words are in the story, I think it requires a team approach.
So. Any follow-up questions to this last 10 or 15 minutes on how you work with your stakeholders? Do you have a question?
Well, it seems to me as I listen to this, we're sort of underselling data in the sense that you've used data to define a problem. Then you go on to the things that you've been talking about. But I guess in my life, I've seen some very effective uses of data sometimes to move the political process. And I wondered if you would talk about the sort of positive side of being able to make a case.
Oh, it's central. It's necessary. It's absolutely necessary. It's just insufficient. Those of you who have had the opportunity of engaging an elected official or a policymaker on an issue. and I encourage you, when you're going to engage that elected official, some people, and there are behaviorists who know this stuff far better than I do. I mean, some people are left brain and some people are right brain. Some people are stories and some people are data. And you got to figure out you know, who you're talking to, right? What moves them? And again, as I mentioned, our view is you got to have both. You got to have dating. You got to have stories. And in the first 3 minutes, you figure out what you're going to lead with. Okay, and some people will respond. Like elected officials and policymakers are really busy people. You probably have about 4 minutes if you have FaceTime with them to grab them, right? You don't have 30 minutes. You don't have 45 minutes as in a lecture or a PowerPoint. You know, you have 4 minutes, okay? And you figure out where you lead. But in my view, it's what works or what tends to work is the combination of the data and story. And then it's a matter of figuring out where you sort of what you lead with and what you frame with. And by the way, there's an organization that we've engaged at the California Endowment called the Frameworks Institute, who does research in framing issues. I mean, how do you know this notion that we're kind of tabula rasa, waiting for data to come in and help us make decisions is not the way it works. People have frames, right? And how do you get your agenda moving within the frame that they have? I encourage you, they probably have a website, and there are other organizations that do this kind of stuff, but we've begun to engage a Frameworks Institute and other folks who help us think about how to frame the evidence-driven case, but make it compelling to either the public or to decision-makers.
I would say also that, you know, it's as a nonprofit, right, the people that I'm delivering data to on a regular basis are the foundations that are funding me. And so the way that they formulate their requests for me, you know, demonstrating my impact is going to have a huge impact on how I collect data. And so that's a conversation. That's a really important one is what are they demanding of me and what is the sort of far horizon of the way that I can demonstrate my impact. And that's going to help me to have more of a vision and include, you know, sort of the research questions that I might not otherwise get to because I'm focused on the direct service or I'm focused on the policy. So I think that plays a huge role in that.
I would add, and I think it's been said quite a bit, data is the floor, and without it, you really can't move forward. But I deal with many people who panic when they see numbers and when they see a spreadsheet or a graph. You can see them just have this look on their face like, oh, my God, I flunked this in school, and I'm never going to understand it. So the story allows them to understand the data. And that's so the key for me is finding a story that brings home the data and gives the message that the data does to someone who might be less functional and comfortable with the data.
Oftentimes the staff people around elected officials are very important. I wonder if you could give an example or two of how you really had to work the staff who oftentimes are there decade after decade and the elected officials come and go.
Yeah, I mean, their job, critical question, because the staffs do determine who gets in and who gets out. They're the gatekeepers. Their job, well, I'll tell you the job of the elected official, right? Get elected, stay elected, seek higher office. Their job is to make their boss look absolutely great and to never have their boss embarrassed or make a mistake. I hope it doesn't sound like a negative way to describe those people. I mean, my daughter was a legislative assistant for a senator, so they are good people. But that's sort of their framework, right? And so when you engage them, let's take children's health insurance coverage as one example. The frame for a progressive left of center legislator and their staff, the opening salvo as you engage even that staff is a different opening sentence than you would for a fiscal conservative, right? So with the fiscal conservative, you lead around children's health coverage, you lead with cost savings, school achievement, and raising kids in a globally competitive marketplace, you know, I mean, right? And with someone who's left of center, you can start with, you know, our kids deserve universal health coverage, right? that goes far enough with that person. With the fiscal conservative, that may get you actually thrown out of the room using the word universal, right? Because universal has, I mean, that's why some people say, I'm against universal health care. They're not against everyone having health care, which is what universal health care means. They think they've equated universal health care with big, expensive government and socialism. Big, giant taxes and socialism and Hillary Clinton and communism and all those bad things. So you're engaging even at the staff level. You're engaging that person in a way that says, okay, what's this person's track record? What have they run their campaigns on? What do they like to extol about themselves in their own campaign literature? And you drive your agenda through that gate. I mean, you find a portal to drive it. And typically, by and large, you can, except with the really ideological reactionaries, you can generally find something in there, at least to start the conversation and get going. But it's a great question because the staff around legislators are just absolutely critical.
Just a quick follow-up, then. Yeah. It sounds like that's coherent with what you said before. You gave two options, take them out or make them look good. So, in other words, the role of the staff is to make them look good. So if you can help the staff make the elected official look good.
I guess I want to say, too, following up on Bob's point about the community organizers and how expert they are at sort of delivering cadres of people that are passionate and understand the political system. And you know, some of our work with physicians and frontline healthcare providers is helping them to understand the role of the legislative assistant and how to deal with them. And so I think expanding the pool of people who understand how the political system works is really critical, because your basic pediatrician doesn't get schooled in that and doesn't know how to go and talk to a legislator and what the pressure points are and all of those things. And so as we expand that knowledge across disciplines, I think that's also going to be more powerful, because if you can walk into that room with a basic understanding of how the system works, you're going to have more of an impact and your message will be listened to differently.
For any legislative aid, at no matter what level, what we have learned is it's follow-up, follow-up, follow-up. So there's no harm in calling to chat from time to time about this or that issue and keeping them abreast of what you're doing in a variety of ways, and visiting if you can often, or inviting them out to visit you whenever they're in town and knowing that they're always welcome. Oftentimes, especially in Washington, folks are changing positions rapidly, but they'll move from one office to the next, and sometimes someone that you might have known 10 years ago all of a sudden ends up in a very powerful position 10 years later. And so keeping those relationships builds a community for you to keep going back to, and those relationships over time become very free-flowing and honest, so you can get great information from folks that can help inform you about what your next step should be.
One last comment on this, because it's another lesson learned. To the extent that you can be, never mind sort of driving your issue, that you can position yourself, or at least your organization, as a resource to that legislative aide. These are typically, you know, like my daughter, really young. She went to work for Senator Kerry. She was 23. She had like three or four issues of which she was an expert in none of them. And stuff is flying in and out and across, you know, these desks, and, you know, a memo, a draft bill, an idea, and oftentimes they just want to know who they can trust to turn to say, listen, this thing is, you know, I'm being asked to evaluate this thing for the Senator. Can you take a look at it and tell me what you think? And so positioning yourself as a resource to that person, way, you know, above and beyond your issue, as someone who can be, who relies on the evidence and the data, right? They're going to go to you. They're not going to get a politically ideological view. They're going to get a data-tested, evidence-screened kind of, you know, point of view on it. And that's really helpful as well, having them see you as a resource to them and make them look really smart in front of their boss, because their boss said, I need a two-page memo on this by Thursday, and today's Tuesday. And, yeah, there's the Internet, but they want to be able to engage some folks that are just really smart and experienced and have that cobbled into the advice that they're going to give their boss.
Bob, one of the arguments in the book is that policy development is often about small gains, that things don't change that quickly. Can you, as leaders,
do anything, do you think, to steer the agenda as those gains begin to accumulate so that you can get the eventual outcomes that you've been pushing all along? How do you deal with that issue of the small gains and moving the agenda forward?
If small gains and incrementalism feels so normal to me, I don't know that there's really very few home runs in the work that we do, right? I mean, right now the big one is healthcare reform, and we've been talking about that for how long? You know, I mean, the issue's been debated longer than some people are than some of the age. I'm looking at some of the faces in the audience. That woman right there is younger than how long we've been talking about healthcare reform. Okay, so I mean, to me, that just feels normal. That you're, by definition, what you're talking about is typically incremental in nature and not home runs. A lot more bunts and singles and walks than home runs.
Well, I really wanted to add something.
I think the folic acid thing is actually an example, and is an exception.
Oh yeah, it's like a home run. But yeah. The process, you take these little, like one of the main things we needed to do was that the science said every woman should get 400 micrograms. And once the March of Dimes talked the FDA into doing it, they only would do one-fourth of what was needed. But we took that one-fourth, and it turns out to be, it's good that we did, because it did a whole heck of a lot of good that we couldn't have anticipated on the first day. Still might not be completely done, but an awful lot was good from having taken that incremental step. But I want to talk back about the staffers. It seems to me that something that's really clear is that these people are young people, and they have enormous power. And it's almost impossible to believe how much power 22-year-olds have, you know, scurrying around those offices. They have an enormous amount of power, so you need to respect them and deal with them. And the other thing is that when I would have people write something for me to give to a staffer, it would always be too complicated. And so you said one page. What I used to say to the people working with me was, and Ellen's mother's in the audience here, is I want you, and maybe you are an expert in what Ellen does, but just assume that you aren't. I said, whatever it is you're going up, no matter how technical it is that you're going to talk, make sure that if you could explain that on one sheet of paper to your mother. And if your mother understands it, the person that you're going to talk to will understand it. And if he or she wants any more detail, you got it out you got a suitcase full of it. You can help whatever they want on that. But if you start giving them the suitcase first, you know, you'll just get killed. I remember early in my career, I'd talk Dr. Fahey, the director of CDC, to go down to Emory with me to beat up somebody, and I thought I had really briefed him really well. And we're walking down the street from the CDC to Emory, and he says, "Godfrey, are we for this or against it?" And you just kill people with too much information.
I have another story in that score, and it's about the reverse in terms of the role of the legislative assistant too, because I had a really wonderful, you know, Ivy League trained doc that I was working with who wanted to do a project on juvenile detention facilities, and he called me for some data, and I said, you know, why don't you call, you know, where do you live? Why don't you call your rep and your senator, because I know that there's been some movement on this issue, and I know that they had researched it, and he had some interest in policy, and he said, I can do that. And I said, yeah, they represent you. You're registered to vote, right? They represent you. Like, they're available to you to engage in this dialogue that Bob was talking about, to be a resource for you, and then you get known to them, and that's how it works. And so here's this guy who's just brilliant in the medicine that he practices, but didn't have a clue on the policy side, and, you know, was able to develop these relationships and engage the policymakers and the 23-year-old legislative assistants with you know, what he was interested in. And I think that had an impact on him, certainly, in the way that he viewed the political process and his role in it. And I think that's really critical, too.
Any other questions? Okay, I'll ask you one now.
You guys are so quiet. Is this helpful?
What do you believe are the most effective ways? Oh, there's a question. You don't want to ask another question? What do you believe are the most effective ways to meet the importance of policy or to insert the importance of policy into the public health dialogue? The presidential candidates have not said very much about public health. How do we get public health more visible in the next administration?
Don't call it public health.
Yeah.
Don't call it public health.
What do you want to call it?
Not social justice. Don't call it that either.
Just to provoke this a little further. Yeah. We talked for Homeland Security. They have talked a lot about prevention, actually. But they put it in the context that all we have to do is more prevention, and that's going to sort of save the day. In fact, there was an article in the New England Journal in about June, I think, kind of taking that whole thing on in terms of the economics of that. So that's out there, and I think will continue to be a subject.
Yeah, you know, this has been a struggle for all of us in public health. It's, you know, we kind of, I'd actually stopped coming to APHA meetings for a few years because I just couldn't stand the whining. Why doesn't anybody like us? prevention is gaining steam. You do hear it on both sides of the aisle. You heard both McCain and Obama talk about it. So prevention is getting some footing. My view on public health, we tend to talk about it. First of all, the name is not good because it has the word public in it, and public denotes government, and government's just not very popular these days. So that's one point. The second point is we tend to view public health as sort of the center of gravity, and we tend to view public health as the ends, right? When in fact, public health is really a really good tool. I think it's kind of like a Swiss Army knife for civic society. It can help fix a lot of stuff. And so what happens is you end up positioning public health at the local level, in particular at the local level. This is harder than the national level. But, you know, you can just about pick any major national challenge that's playing out at the local level, and public health has a tool in the toolbox to help fix it, okay? Juvenile justice, domestic violence, prisoner reentry, incarceration, what'd you say?
Hunger.
Homelessness, housing issue. I mean, I haven't yet figured out how we can help fix the foreclosure crisis yet, but I'm sure someone's going to come up with it. And so we have to kind of, I'm challenging ourselves, all of us, to kind of be willing to accept new frames. And one frame is that we tend to, in public health, we tend to measure our worth by the number of FTEs and the size of our budget, right? And whether we have direct reporting to the elected official, I have to report to two or three layers. And I understand there's a space for that in the conversation. But I think those of you, and I'm sure there's some of you in the audience, you've been part of really effective, exciting, collaborative relationship partnership where public health wasn't in the lead. Okay? It may have been in preventing gang violence or school dropout rates or chronic absenteeism in schools. And the lead is sort of something else or some other issue, but public health is bringing a powerful set of tools. And sometimes it's a disciplined, evidence-based kind of approach. We tend not to get fooled by conventional wisdom. Back to the point about data, we tend to be, please read Freakonomics. Please read that book, Freakonomics. And then the second book to read is The Power of Unreasonable People. And leadership is being unreasonable people. But in Freakonomics, it just talks a lot about how all of this politically infused conventional wisdom is BS. In a lot of cases. And public health rarely gets fooled that way. because we tend to be very good about relying on evidence and the data, but at the same time, jumping out of our box is enough to know that we can be a powerful ally, sometimes a quiet ally, but a powerful ally in helping folks solve problems that don't come in public health clothing. They come in some other clothing, and I think you can build slowly, particularly at the local level and at the state level, you can build a powerful case for public health as Lester Breslow calls it, a resource rather than an end. And that's my soliloquy on it.
Quick follow-up on the foreclosure thing. Actually, you got me thinking. Yeah. Isn't that argument, I suppose, that Senator Obama's latest proposal on the three-month moratorium is kind of a public health approach? In other words, it's saying let's kind of just treat everyone the same here for a few months. Let this thing settle down. I mean, I'm stretching a little bit.
Oh, kudos to you for stretching.
If he called in his public health people to come up with that idea, probably didn't. But anyway.
Well, a great way to destigmatize mental health and mental illness in this country is to use the mortgage foreclosure crisis. I mean, there is an opportunity to talk about. I mean, do you know what this country is going to go through over the next 2 years? The millions and millions of families that are going to be dealing with serious depression and mental health issues as a result of this screw-up from Wall Street. And so it's ugly, but there's an opportunity, if you're on the mental health side of this, to kind of push a mental health destigmatization and support agenda, because Americans are going to be dealing with some serious crisis issues.
I want to give the panelists a chance to make any final comments that they'd like to make. And they've, after the session, they've agreed to sign your books if you'd like. You can come up and get their autographs. So, Ellen, any final?
Closing argument, I guess.
Where did I hear that?
I was just sitting here thinking about the challenge about incorporating public health, and I think that it's starting to happen organically, and the perch that I see it from is watching students who come through, and the number of dual degrees that I think are becoming more common, and not to say that is a strategy to be devoutly followed, but I think it says, and you can see it's on the panel here, it says that there are lots of different skill sets that we need in order to solve these problems. And as I've shared with some of my panelists, every day I feel the missing link of an MPH that would help me to understand some of the work that I do better. And so I think bringing that public health approach and that public health perspective is going to be coming more organically over time as a result of the incorporation of public health into these other contexts, into these other settings, and it will become more fluid and more of a common terminology. And I think that's part of the beauty of this work, is because of its flexibility combined with rigor. And that's what I really admire about it. And I think Bob's right or was it Liz who talked about the floor of data? And I think that's really important. And that's a floor that the legal community has never had, and the legal community really needs. And we have to look to the public health world to establish that. So
I've said enough. I just want to thank Pfizer for supporting this.
You've kind of stemmed a long-running household discussion I had with my husband, who is a film producer and a television writer and very creative. And whenever I talk about public health things, he says, "Oh, you just worry all the time." And I said, "No, I'm not worried. I'm trying to prevent this." He said, "No, it sounds like worry." So I think some of us, as we have friends and family members and other professionals we know who are in more creative fields, it is a question of framing and messaging and what do we call this, so people understand there's a set of skills that can be very useful that we all call public health, but that for whatever reason, outside of this wonderful group of people, people don't get jazzed about it. So there is a marketing piece here. And I think it would be worth some of us spending some time on it.
Well, thanks also to Pfizer, and it's been interesting for me to get to know you guys. I mean, to figure out what you did and to see the wonderful things that you've done. And I think we ought to stop and think about our successes. We shouldn't just be whining. Bill Fahey once said in the middle of the Reagan administration, I think it was in his lecture to the APHA, all you guys are worried about how things have gone backwards. It's look back 50 years and see where we've come. And so we need to have a think about those successes. And they do happen. And almost in prevention, of course, there's something called the paradox of prevention. You're only known by your failures. So the 10,000 parents that have had kids with spina bifida and anencephaly, without spina bifida and anencephaly, in the last 10 years, have not called up me or anybody at the CDC or the FDA to say, thank you very much for doing that, and we got 10 endowed chairs, we're going to do that for you. On. Just not how the world works. You just have to understand that. And I tell my kids that every time somebody eats a hot dog bun, it's sort of compounding the prevention that the folic acid story. And it's just like Bill Gates and DOS. Every time you turn on a machine, the Microsoft gets a chick. Except Bill Gates got rich, and your dad just got rich off of knowing the good happened.
Well, thank our panelists.
Stories are inspirational. The other people whose stories are in the book are, I think, will show you how much and how many contributions many of us in public health make. And so I hope you will read that. Barbara DeBona was supposed to be here today. She's got some family crisis, and she's unable to attend. But I know she's here in spirit. And Ana Rita Gonzalez, who was also supposed to be here, who's worked with Pfizer and is one of the co-authors of the monograph Moments in Leadership, also apologizes for not being here as well. So please take a look at the book. Come up and have a little personal chat. We've got a few extra minutes, and we hope that you enjoyed the session. This session will be followed by a very interesting session of award-winning projects done with the Public Health Leadership Institute. So you'll be able to see their posters and have chats with some of the people that have gone through the leadership development programs in the United States. And the quality and the wonderful ideas that many of our public health professionals bring to their management and leadership roles is also very inspirational. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very nicely done. Appreciate
you. I felt bad that Barbara couldn't be here because she was so excited about doing it.
Thank you. I actually one of my failures.
Thanks.
I was at the Institute of Medicine.
Congratulations.
We visited you when we were doing our study on primary care.
Yes, I remember that.
But and the trouble was we were just at the wrong time. You know, timing is hard. But I also was the study director for the Iowa study on the future of public health. So I wrote those words, which did seem to make an effort. But it's good to see Carl,
how are you? Nice to meet you.
Sit on my butt. What are you doing here, man?
I would be happy.
Thank you. You were very inspirational. Thank you.
To Bill?
I don't know how this other sound.
Yeah, man.
But I enjoyed it. You have a choice.
Oh, thank you, brother.
The Lord
is not finished with you, right?
Well, I am still. That's great. I'm so good at knowing you, I didn't listen to you.
Oh, good. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Nice to meet you. What's your name,
Dorothy?
Go good.
I was taking notes.
You too. Thank you.
You have a good work.
Yeah, somebody's coming down here.
to talk about.
Good to see you.
Take care. Thank you.
All right. Say hello to Robin.
I will.
Thank you so much. Oh, that's
Yeah. Oh, and I haven't done it?
Well, you said
time, please.
VP of Strategic Plan and a few others.
We're
actually engaged in setting up.
Where would you like it on?
Yeah, once you make it up.
Okay.
I'm all in.
Are we going to have a book with all of
the
New York?
Well,
LA. From New York.
That means all of the far more heavy literature.
Oh, please.
Well, would you mind finding
my mom right here?
That is so nice to meet you. I'm so glad you're here. I wish I had my mother here, but I didn't bring her.
Well, that she could come is wonderful. That's a blessing.
Yeah, she could have come, yeah.
Isn't that
she's actually true? Playing in a bridge tournament and didn't come. I didn't invite her either. I actually didn't tell her about this. I wasn't quite.
That's sure right. Sometimes you don't tell your mother about
it. You can't tell your mother everything.
I caused you much trouble.
Well, no, they don't usually cause trouble.
No, they're fun to have with you.
They were absolutely marvelous.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm on the board, thanks to when I helped it.
Oh, okay.
So it turned out really well.
So you got continuity.
Yeah, continuity.
Right. Good handle.
Nicely done.
Yes, it's really good handle.
Not like the Americans in the Olympics.
No.
The baton wasn't dropped.
No, the baton was not dropped. There's going to be this development there as well.
Talk about double-degree students. Have a double-degree.
Oh, okay. Great. Where are you at?
University of
Kentucky. Oh, you know we have a medical legal partnership.
Really?
You have to go and find it.
Where are you at?
I'm in Boston. I understand.
It's on our website. We can be right down. Do you have a book?
I'm not doing that much.